Let's start this session with a short meditation. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, let go of any external distractions and allow your awareness to descend into your body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed. Completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or force the breath in any way. Simply allowing it to flow effortlessly, naturally. And then without dwelling in the past, without anticipating the future, simply allow the mind to come to rest in the stillness of the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you most distinctly notice any sensations associated with the breath. find yourself being caught up in distraction, then use the out-breath as an opportunity to relax, to release the distraction, and very gently return to focusing on the breath. So relax, release, and return. Or if you find yourself caught up in dullness or being spaced out, then use the in-breath as an opportunity to refresh your interest in the practice, to restore your attention on the breath, and then retain an ongoing flow of mindfulness. So refresh, restore, and retain. We all want to be happy, and we all want to be free of suffering. And it often seems to us as if though the source of our happiness and the source of our suffering is out there in the world. And as a result, one of the main methods we use to try to find happiness and overcome suffering is that we try to manipulate the things around us. We try to attract people, places, and things that seem to be the source of our happiness. And we try to push away or avoid people, places, and things that seem to be the source of our suffering. But no matter how hard we try to do this, we still encounter suffering, and we're still chasing after that elusive happiness. all we are really doing with this method is that we are trapping ourselves in the hope-fear cycle. Hoping for pleasant experiences and fearing or worrying about unpleasant experiences. And if we don't get the things we want, we often become very frustrated. And even if we do get the things we want, they never seem to really completely satisfy us. And we simply end up craving for more. And then we often end up with a lot of dissatisfaction when things don't live up to our expectations. However, if we look closely, if we investigate closely, we'll come to see that the actual source of our suffering and the actual source of our happiness lies within our own mind. It's our mental afflictions, such as attachment and anger and jealousy and confusion, that is the real source of our suffering. And that these mental afflictions are coming from our distorted view of reality. They're coming from grasping onto an independent me and grasping onto an independent objective world. So if we really want to overcome our suffering and find that genuine happiness, then we need to reduce and eliminate our mental afflictions. And we need to eliminate this ignorance that is at their root. We need to come to realize the nature of reality, to realize emptiness, to realize there is no independent subjective me and no independent objective world. And in this way, then, we can overcome all of our mental afflictions and the suffering they produce and achieve liberation and achieve genuine happiness, a state completely free of all suffering and its causes. We can set a motivation for this weekend of wishing to come to understand this path that can enable us to achieve genuine happiness, liberation from suffering. And also to be motivated to implement this so we can improve our lives. And we can try to extend that motivation out to include others. Not just wishing to overcome our own suffering and find genuine happiness for ourselves, but so that we can then help those around us also to overcome their suffering and help them to find genuine happiness as well. And then keeping this motivation in mind, we can slowly now bring this meditation to a close, and we can begin our discussions together this afternoon. And so we are now going to begin our discussions using this text here, this Foundation of All Good Qualities by Lama Tsongkhapa. So remember, Lama Tsongkhapa was the founder of the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism that he expanded upon the Lam Rim approach to practice that was introduced into Tibet by great Indian master Lama Atisha. And so I thought it would be a good idea to begin our discussions that first we could maybe read the text together, because it's quite a short text, so that we can start to become familiar at least with the words of the text. So let's read the text together to begin. So, the foundation of all good qualities. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure Guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and difficult to find again. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly, day and night, takes its essence. This life as is impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like a shadow follows the body, the results of black and white karma follow. Finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me always to be careful to abandon even the slightest of negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. Seeking samsaric pleasures is the door to all suffering. They are uncertain and cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate the strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness, and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the pratimoksha vows. Please bless me to accomplish this essential practice. Just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all mother migratory beings. Bless me to see this, train in supreme bodhicitta, and bear the responsibility of freeing migratory beings. Even if I develop only bodhicitta, without practicing the three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. Once I have pacified distractions to wrong objects and correctly analyzing the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. Having become a pure vessel by training in the general path, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, the supreme Vajra vehicle. At that time, the basis of accomplishing the two attainments is keeping pure vows and samaya. As I have become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. Then, having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, by practicing with great energy, never giving up the four sessions, please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. Like that, may the Gurus who show the noble path and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. Please bless me to pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. And in all my lives, never separated from perfect gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities of the stages and the paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. So again, this is a text outlining the Lam Rim, the stages of the path approach to practice within the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism. So this, of course, is a very brief text in the verse form that basically just gives the overview of the entire Lam Rim structure. So let's have a look at the various components here within this Lam Rim, the stages of the path to enlightenment. So the first verse is talking, it says, the foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. So this is talking about relying on a teacher. Now here, of course, we see the word guru. And actually what we're going to see in this Lam Rim structure is that we can approach the spiritual path to enlightenment at a number of levels. And those levels sort of map onto the three vehicles that we looked at previously. These three vehicles of Theravada, Mahayana, and Vajrayana are not somehow three different vehicles that we choose one or the other. What we're going to see through this text is that these three vehicles of Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana are actually three levels of practice. That the foundation level of practice is the Theravada level of practice, and then we can build on that in terms of the Mahayana level of practice, and then we can build on that in terms of the Vajrayana level of practice. And so, therefore, we can talk about a teacher who can really introduce and help us at each of those three levels. And often, at those various levels of practice, the teacher is referred to using a different name. So the word guru here, generally in Buddhism, is referring to a teacher who can guide us at the Vajrayana level of practice. So, at the foundation level of practice, the level where we are aspiring for a good future and we are aspiring to be free of suffering, i.e. the Theravada level of practice, at that level, within those traditions, the teacher is often called a Thera. And Thera means elder, someone sort of elder in the spiritual path who has more experience than us that can guide us in the spiritual path. When we come to the Mahayana level of practice, the teacher is often referred to in Sanskrit as a Kalyana Mitra. And this Kalyana Mitra word is often translated into English as something like virtuous spiritual friend. So again, those of you who've studied Lam Rim often come across this term, this virtuous spiritual friend. So this is the translation of Kalyana Mitra. This word translated into Tibetan is Geshe. Ge is short for Gewa, meaning virtue, and She is short for Shenyen, meaning friend. So, virtuous spiritual friend. What we need to be careful of these days, of course, is this word Geshe now, in the modern day, is simply an academic title. It just means that someone has studied a lot, generally 10 to 20 years of study, has passed some exact academic exams, and then they're given this academic title of Geshe. So when you hear someone's called Geshe this, Geshe that, now, it simply means that you can be fairly sure they've done quite a lot of study and have passed some academic exams. Whether or not they're a Kalyana Mitra, whether or not they're a qualified teacher of Mahayana, we still need to check out. So we shouldn't automatically assume they're a qualified teacher just because they've got this title. Historically, of course, in early Tibet, if someone was called Geshe, that was not because they had passed some academic exams. It was because they really were a qualified teacher of Mahayana. And then we have the term guru that comes here in the beginning of this text. And guru is usually the name for the teacher at the level of Vajrayana. So guru literally means someone heavy with qualities. And within Buddhism, a guru is someone really who's a qualified teacher of Tantra or Vajrayana. The word guru translated into Tibetan is Lama. But again, we need to be careful with this word nowadays, because often this word in our modern society is simply used often to refer to an elder monk or an elder person as a sign of respect. So just because someone's called Lama this, Lama that, nowadays, we shouldn't automatically assume they're a qualified teacher of Vajrayana.
we need to check them out. But technically, historically, a lama was, a guru was a qualified teacher of Vajrayana. So here in the text, when it talks about the teacher, relying on a teacher, it uses the word guru, because within this text is within the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, and in Tibetan Buddhism, that's the highest level of practice. So this is, of course, what we are eventually aspiring to, and hence we see the use of the word guru. And here it says the foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure guru. So what does it mean for the guru to be kind? And that is that they're very kind in that they introduce us to the spiritual path in general. So they introduce us to all the different practices. But then, of course, they, as well, they would explain, give us personal advice. So not just give a general introduction into the spiritual path, but they would give us personal advice. Now, of course, the question arises here is that, do we really need a teacher? And here this text seems to say that this is the foundation. And this comes at the beginning of this text. And also, those of you who've studied Lam Rim, of course, the very first topic is this relying on a teacher, which seems to indicate that the very first thing we need to do is find a teacher. Now, what we need to remember, of course, is this Lam Rim texts were written in ancient Tibet. And at that time, of course, most people were illiterate. There were very few texts around anyway. And the only way we could begin a spiritual path was to hear some instructions from a teacher. If there was no teacher available, then we couldn't begin to do anything. Whereas, of course, in our modern society, that's not the case anymore. You know, most of us can read. There are plenty of books around. We have access to a lot of audio, video stuff. So without having a personal teacher, we can now actually begin to do something in the spiritual path. But having said that, there are a lot of advantages to having a personal teacher and to rely on them. Because a personal teacher not only can give us the general instructions, which we could maybe get from a book or so forth, but they will be able to give us personal instructions. Because each of us are individual. Each of us have different abilities, different needs, or different levels. And so while all of these different practices are beneficial, we don't have unlimited time. And so we'd like to be as effective as possible by focusing on those particular practices that would be most beneficial for us now. How to know that from a book would be more or less impossible. Whereas a teacher, if they're a qualified teacher, of course, they will know us better than we know ourselves, and they can really see what we as an individual really need now. So they can really tailor the spiritual path according to our specific needs so that we can make our spiritual practice most effective. So this, of course, is one big advantage with having a personal teacher. And, of course, also the personal teacher is someone who's really progressed a long way on the spiritual path. So not only can we get personal instruction, but they would be a source of inspiration to us, that we could see that, you know, this is something that we are aspiring to. So really, by having that personal teacher, we can receive a lot of inspiration from them. So this can also really help us. Also, what a personal teacher can do is, you know, we do a particular practice, but we may not understand exactly how to do it. So we're doing the practice, but we're doing it in a mistaken way. And it's hard to know that from our own experience. Whereas if we have a teacher, they can correct any mistakes in the way we do the practice. But also, of course, even if we're doing the practice correctly, sometimes we come up against sort of obstacles in our practice, and these obstacles can be external or internal obstacles. And often we find it difficult to know even what the obstacle is and then how to overcome it. Whereas a teacher can really be helpful in helping us to overcome all sorts of obstacles in our practice, whether they're external or internal. And often they can actually turn that obstacle into an opportunity, fuel for us. But for us to do that ourselves often is very difficult to do. So, therefore, these are some of the advantages to having a personal teacher. And that's how they can be very kind to us. But it says here that we are, it's the foundation of all qualities is the kind and perfect pure guru, which indicates that we need to make sure that our teacher is a qualified teacher and not just accept the first person that comes along. So how can we understand if our teacher is a qualified teacher? And so I think for many of us here, particularly we're aspiring at least to the sort of the Mahayana level of practice and then maybe later the Vajrayana, then the text in the Lam Rim text then describe what qualities should we look for in a teacher of the Mahayana. So normally the Lam Rim texts talk about 10 qualities that we really should look for in a teacher. So a Kalyanamitra, a qualified teacher of Mahayana, of course the Mahayana is based on the Theravada level of practice. And at that level, we saw that the core practices were ethics, concentration, wisdom. So therefore, of course, a qualified teacher of Mahayana needs also to have that solid foundation themselves. So they also need to be well practiced in ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And here, of course, this wisdom we're talking about at the foundation level is this wisdom of no self or selflessness. Now, of course, in the Mahayana, then, well, in all levels of the practice, the teacher, of course, needs to have greater knowledge and experience than the student. So that's the fourth quality. And what we can see in the Mahayana vehicle, that is a very vast vehicle with many different practices. And if the teacher only has experiences in a very small subset of those practices, and our needs fall outside of that, they're not going to be very helpful to us. So that teacher really needs to have a broad understanding of many practices within the Mahayana. So here, the fifth quality is they need to have what's called a wealth of scriptural knowledge, meaning having a very broad knowledge of many, many different practices in the Mahayana. But then, of course, here in the Mahayana, the wisdom practice, the Vipassana practice, the wisdom we need to develop or cultivate is this wisdom of emptiness. So, of course, if we want to do that, then the teacher needs to have realized emptiness themselves to be able to help us to do that. But of course, in addition to this, the teacher needs to be putting effort into helping us.
If the teacher's very lazy, then of course they're not much use to us. So the seventh quality is they need to have what's called diligence. They need to be putting effort into trying to help us. But not only do they need to be putting effort into helping us, they need to have a correct motivation for helping us. So then they need to, they need to be able to communicate well with us. Because even if they know all these things, but they can't communicate effectively with us, then we don't understand what they're saying, they're no help to us. So they need to be skilled in teaching. But not only do they need to be skilled in teaching, they need to have a good motivation for helping us and not just trying to help because they want to become famous or whatever. They need to have the correct motivation to help us, and that is the motivation of great compassion. But also on top of that, you know, sometimes we don't pick up things very quickly. We're a bit slow to pick up things. So if they become frustrated with that and give up, then they're no help to us. So also they need to have great patience with us. So these are the qualities that we need to look for in a teacher, qualified teacher of Mahayana. But if we look at this list of 10 things, we might think it could be a little bit difficult to find someone who has all these qualities. Maybe they're not so easy to find. And then the text says, okay, there are 5 qualities in this list of 10 which are really the core ones that we really focus on. So out of these 10, which are the sort of 5 core qualities that we should be looking for? Well, I think all the first 3, because that's the foundation. And then what's the other 2? Yes, great compassion and emptiness, yes. So the 2 wings of wisdom and compassion. So these are the 5 core qualities that we are to look for in the teacher. But sometimes then the texts go on to say, well, even that might be difficult to find. So then sometimes the texts say, well, as a rock bottom minimum, there are 3 things to look for. And these 3 things are not in this list. And the 3 things are that the first one is that the teacher should have more qualities than faults. So that's the first one. The second one is that they should be thinking more of future lives than this life. Which, what that really means is that person caught up in the 8 worldly concerns? Is that teacher looking for a good reputation, money, fame, wealth? If they are, they're not a qualified teacher. And then the third point is they should be thinking more of others than themselves. So again, if they're caught up in this very selfish motivation, rather than really trying to help others, they're not a qualified teacher. So these are the things we are to look for in a qualified teacher of the Mahayana. So in the text it says here that the foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect pure guru. So again, that to rely on a qualified teacher, particularly qualified teacher of Mahayana with these sorts of qualities, is the foundation of all the good qualities of the spiritual path. And then it says, correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort,
please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. So how are we to rely? What does it mean to rely upon the teacher? Well, for us to rely upon a teacher means that we, from our side, need to be a qualified student. So what does it mean to be a qualified student? And here the Lamrim texts talk about three things. The first quality that we should have as a student is that we should be unbiased. Unbiased here means to not disparage or put down any other valid traditions. Meaning, if we, for example, think that Buddhism is the best and all other traditions like Christianity and Islam and so forth are inferior, we're not a qualified student of Buddhism. The second quality we need as a student is wisdom, and here the wisdom is called discriminating wisdom. And here discriminating wisdom means to not blindly follow the advice of the teacher. So discriminating wisdom means to listen to the instructions of the teacher, and then to see whether or not these instructions are beneficial or they're unethical. And if they're unethical, not to follow them. So this is discriminating wisdom. So again, if we are simply blindly following the advice of our teacher, we're not a qualified student. And the third is that we need to put effort, and we need to put effort into two things. We need to put effort into study and effort into practice. Study, of course, means to listen to teachings, think about them, to get a clear picture of the spiritual path, to develop a framework for practice. But then, of course, if we only do that and we don't practice, no change will take place. But on the basis of developing that intellectual framework, we need to practice. We need to meditate. We need to integrate these things into our daily life so those changes can start to take place. When I first came to Buddhism, I think I had about 1.5 out of 3 qualities. I definitely was not unbiased. I definitely thought Buddhism was the best. Everything else was inferior. I think I had pretty good discriminating wisdom. I never tended to blindly accept anything. I put some effort into study, and I put 0 effort into practice. Now I think I'm pretty good on being less biased, and I'm starting to put a little bit of effort into practice. So, a little bit better now. So, if you want to really be a qualified student and to really rely on a teacher, then if you don't have these qualities, then we need to make sure we cultivate and develop these qualities. Then, it says that in that same thing, that we are to rely upon them with great respect, and we are to have correct devotion to them. So what does it mean to have correct devotion and rely with great respect? So how to rely on the teacher is we can rely on them in terms of thought, our attitude, and in terms of our behavior, our action. And in terms of our thought or attitudes, it's generally talked about we need to have faith in the teacher, because like anything, if we don't have faith in something, then we won't really be able to take advantage of that. And then, of course,
we need to have respect for the teacher. So that's in terms of our thought. We need to have faith and respect for the teacher. And then in terms of our action, in terms of our behavior, it said we can help, we can do three things. We can, in terms of the teacher, we can offer material help to the teacher, you know, money or whatever they need. We can offer service to the teacher, you know, if they need someone to cook for them or to take them around or so forth. We can support them in this way. But in the third way, and that is to basically follow their advice. This is what really would make the teacher most happy, is if we followed their advice. But again, here we need to make sure we have discriminating wisdom. In that, if they give us some advice, and we really believe that advice to be unethical, then we must not follow that advice. We must ask them why it's not unethical. If they can't give a good reason or a good explanation as why it's not unethical, then we should not follow that advice. So, then in terms of relying on the teacher, in terms of our relationship to the teacher, there's often an analogy given there that can be very helpful. And that is the analogy of a fire. You know, usually if we're too close to a fire, we can get burnt. And if we're too far from the fire, we won't receive any warmth. Likewise with a teacher, if we're too close to the teacher, we can get burnt. In terms of if we are sort of like living next door to the teacher and we're seeing them all the time, then often what will happen is we're going to start to project faults on the teacher that are not really there because of our deluded mind. We often start to project and imagine all sorts of things which are not reality. And also, if we're too close to the teacher, often what will happen is that we will use the teacher to absolve personal responsibility. Meaning any time we've got any little decision to make, we'll simply run off to the teacher and say, what should I do? This is not going to be very healthy for us. And if they're a qualified teacher, they will be very harsh on us if we do this. If we go to them with petty questions, then they really are just going to say, go away and work that out yourself. Of course, if we're too far from the teacher, we don't receive any warmth. Meaning we're not able to get any personal advice, we won't be able to receive that inspiration that we need in the spiritual path. So it's very important to be able to have some personal connection with the teacher from time to time. That may only be a few times a year, but at least that is important. So we need to make sure we have this healthy distance from the teacher, close enough to get personal advice and inspiration, but not too close, where we end up with these problems of codependency and start to see faults in the teacher. And then at the end of this verse it says, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. So all these verses end with this, please bless me. So with this text, again, it's a text that can be used in terms of, as a basis for a meditation called a glance meditation, where we are going through this and refreshing our understanding of the various parts of the path. And so this please bless me would be that in the meditation, of course, normally, often what we do at the beginning of the meditation is we have what's called this merit field in front of us. Again, as part of the meditation practice. And that merit field can be a very extensive visualization of the Buddha and all the various different deities and lineage teachers and all sorts of things, very elaborate. Or a more brief one, we could have someone like Shakyamuni in the middle
And then we can have the representations of the aspects of wisdom and compassion, maybe Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara or Chenrezig, or simply we could have Shakyamuni Buddha, or simply our teacher. And this is called the merit field. And so then when we're doing our meditative practice, we are doing that, imagining these beings in front of us, again, for inspiration and in our practice. So then when we're doing this practice and then we say, please bless me, we are doing that, we're saying, you know, whoever we have in this merit field, please bless me, meaning please inspire me to be able to do this, to, in this case, to rely upon the teacher with great respect. And this brings up the idea of a blessing. So we see this idea of blessing a lot. And so, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, you know, we often hear, oh, I'm going down the temple so I can get a blessing from the Dalai Lama, you know. And so often people think that they'll just go down there and somehow the Dalai Lama will zap them and they'll be sort of have some mystical experience, you know. But actually, a couple of years ago, I was at a audience with His Holiness, a small group of us, and he was talking about something, and then at one point he said, you know, I can't give you a blessing. Whether or not you get a blessing from being here is up to you. It depends on you. Because blessing, in Tibetan is chinlap, and that literally means to transform into a magnificent state. So a blessing is when we transform our mind into a very positive state. So of course that's up to us. Of course someone like the Dalai Lama could be a very good condition to make it easier for us to do that. But whether or not that happens is up to us, not them, whoever it is. So here a blessing is simply, again, with faith and devotion and respect to whatever, whoever we have in the merit field, we simply ask for guidance and inspiration so that we can do whatever we're asking here. In this case, please inspire me, please bless me to be able to rely on the teacher with great respect. So this is what it means to receive a blessing. So this is the first verse. Any questions about this? About relying on the teacher? Yeah, Mika.
I would like to ask, how does teacher remove external obstacles?
How do they remove external obstacles? Well, of course, a teacher can't remove any internal or external obstacles themselves directly. If they could, we'd all be enlightened, because the Buddha would have waved his magic wand, dispelled it all, and we'd all be enlightened now. So all that they can do is that they can help us to be able to do that. They can give us advice and guidance, inspiration and so forth, so that we can do that ourselves. So that's how they can help us to do that. But they can't do that directly in that sense. Yeah.
A question about the qualities of the teacher.
Right.
Not all of them are visible to us. For example, we cannot know whether the teacher has a perfect concentration or whether he has realized emptiness.
Sure.
So.
Yeah. Yes. So when it says in the text that we need to check out the teacher for these qualities, one thing it says is that we should take time to do that. In fact, in the old text here, it often said, sometimes you'll see in the text, it says it may take you up to 12 years to check out the teacher. So the first point is that it'll maybe takes time. Of course, 12 years, I mean, you remember in those days, the teacher was probably someone who came to your village once or twice a year and then was gone for the rest of the year. So how to check them out, except for when they're there for a short time, difficult. So it may take quite a number of visits to be able to check them out. But now, of course, we have internet, we have a lot of communication, and generally if a teacher is not very qualified and has really some big faults, that will become quickly known. So we can find that out more quickly. So it's a lot easier in our modern society. But again, the message is to take time to check them out and be careful not to just pick the teacher because they're very charismatic and they speak nicely
and because they have a lot of followers, they must be good because a lot of people are following them. We can just be then one of these sheep following as well, you know. There's a lot of sheep following. Oh, they must know what they're doing. Let's do the same, you know. We don't want to do that. I mean, really, we see a lot of big mess in our modern society because of this. So we need to check them out. Again, some of these qualities are difficult to determine. Of course, we can observe their behavior in terms of ethics. Generally, in concentration, if the teacher is very peaceful and calm and doesn't, particularly if there's some strong stimulus comes, they don't sort of react. They're very calm and peaceful and respond. This is a sign that they've probably got some good concentration. And also these other things as well, a lot of them we can sort of see from their behavior. But then also what we can do is if this teacher is part of a bigger tradition, and we know someone else who's respected in that tradition, we can ask them, what do they think of this person? And they will probably have a very good, clear understanding of that person. So, therefore, if a teacher is within a larger organization and is accepted in that organization, that's also a good sign that, you know, they have quite a lot of qualities. Where we have to be even more careful is if there's a teacher that's sort of their own individual thing. They're not part of a larger group. And we see that quite a lot. That's okay, because maybe the teacher has found that in the modern society, their approach to teaching is more effective than what they've been doing in their organization. So you'll find teachers breaking off and providing a good teaching. But, of course, there it's more difficult to check. And sometimes teachers break off because maybe, you know, then they can just do their own thing and no one's really checking up on them. So if we find a teacher or someone we may think to be a teacher and they're not part of a larger group or a well-established tradition, we need to even be more careful because we don't want to just follow them because they happen to have a lot of people following and they sound great and we can get up into a lot of trouble. So, yes, take your time. And, of course, what we can do is just go to their teachings as a general thing and just listen to what they have to say and see whether it makes sense, you know. And then if and when we find they're suitable, then we can try to later approach and to have a personal connection to that teacher. So, again, just to check them out thoroughly before accepting them.
Oh, but still number six. Not yeah.
Well, what we can do there, of course, is that if we have received some teachings on emptiness and we have some sort of vague understanding of emptiness, then we can go to a teaching that they're teaching on emptiness and see what they're saying. Does it sort of make sense? Are they very clear and coherent about what they're saying? So that's an indication they have some experience. But, of course, to have directly realized emptiness, how can we know that directly? We can't. But if they have, then directly realizing emptiness would imply their sense of grasping onto self is much reduced and their kindness and compassion should be really quite vast. So we can see from their behavior as well, you know, if they're seeming to be quite selfish, if they don't really have a lot of loving kindness and compassion for others, then they won't have realized emptiness. Because that's a consequence of realizing emptiness is that the grasping onto the self, me, is very much reduced. You should find that if they realize emptiness, they should be very unselfish in their behavior. They should be really just working for the benefit of others. So that's a way of indirectly sort of checking that.
But here it means at least conceptual.
Well, realized emptiness, of course, in best case, is if they've had a direct realization. But at least some taste or experience of emptiness in meditation, more than just some good intellectual understanding.
And what would then be the difference between 3 and 6?
Well, 3 is this idea of selflessness, mm-hmm. And emptiness is a deeper realization. I'm going to touch on that difference a little bit tomorrow afternoon. They can be a condition.
Yeah,
so
what is the cause?
The cause is our own mind. Yeah, that's the cause.
Yeah, I was just wondering because it seems like it's really emphasized here.
Correct.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, so again, please bless me is to basically, you know, whoever we have imagined in front of us, our teacher, the Buddha, Lama Tsongkhapa, Maitreya, whatever, is to, this please bless me is to really to ask for inspiration. So it's a way of opening our mind and so that we're more receptive, so that this, whatever we're trying to do, is more likely to penetrate our mind. So it's a way of sort of opening ourselves to be able to do this. And it really is to inspire us, because the more our mind is uplifted and inspired, the more easy it is for us to, for things to really penetrate us and to deepen our understanding and experience.
However, there are objects which can be blessed by some teachers.
Yes, again, this is talking at a physical level, an energetic level. Here we're talking at the mental level. Of course, someone like Dalai Lama or someone like that probably has a very strong physical presence because of their subtle energies and so forth. So they could have an immediate sort of physical. And we know that, you know, when we see someone like that come in the room, they seem to immediately have some positive impact on us. Yeah. But here really we're talking, but of course it's really up to our mind as well, you know, because if our mind is very closed and negative, even if the Dalai Lama walks in the room, we may sort of even get angry at them. You know, that's like Devadatta, his cousin, thought, you know, the Buddha was a phony and tried to kill him. So, you know, so it really, it depends on our state of mind. So these, of course, people like the Dalai Lama can be a very strong stimulus to be a condition for us to be inspired. So, you know, that combination, but it's really up to our own state of mind whether or not any blessing takes place. So the actual underlying cause is our own mind, and that external influence from Dalai Lama, whoever, is the condition to help that transformation to take place. But at an energetic level, of course, they can have some direct energetic impact on physical objects, of course.
The three words applying great effort, is it fighting against laziness, or how would you explain it?
Great effort. Now we're talking about student qualities? In the student qualities, or where?
No, in the verse.
Oh, by applying great effort. Yeah, so here, effort, of course, is, we can talk about in terms of overcoming laziness, yes. So, of course, great effort here is, means to joyfully do this, of course, as well. So, when we see this effort, it doesn't mean sort of like it's some hardship, but to joyfully do it. And yes, often we talk about the three types of laziness that we are trying to overcome. And one laziness is called procrastination, just sort of putting things off all the time. Another laziness is the laziness of just getting caught up in meaningless activities, you know, that instead of doing something meaningful, we sort of just busy ourselves with meaningless activities. And the other type of laziness is the laziness that of feeling inadequate. I can't do it. I'm not good enough. So this is to overcome those three types of laziness. But again, it's a joyful effort, of course. It's not like, oh, I have to do this. Okay, let's break for afternoon tea and come back at 4 o'clock. So we've got about 20 minutes for afternoon tea.